Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So I'll be reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 24, and there's quite a few verses without purports, so I will just read the English until we get to text 53 through 55. 55 is on the board, so we'll read that together. So I'll just go through the English now, beginning with text 35. Actually, I'll start with text 34, so we kind of have a reference from yesterday. I'll start from 33. So, text 33 through 55. As soon as Kunti called for the demigod of the sun, he immediately appeared before her, and she was very much surprised. She told the sun god, "I was simply examining the effectiveness of this mystic power. I am sorry I have called you unnecessarily. Please return and excuse me." The sun god said, "Oh, beautiful Pritha, your meeting with the demigods cannot be fruitless. Therefore, let me place my seed in your womb so that you may bear a son. I shall arrange to keep your virginity intact since you are still an unmarried girl." After saying this, the sun god discharged his semen into the womb of Pritha and then returned to the celestial kingdom. Immediately thereafter, from Kunti, a child was born, who was like a second sun god. Because Kunti feared people's criticism, with great difficulty she had to give up her affection for her child. Unwillingly, she packed the child in a basket and let it float down the waters of the river. O Maharaj Parikshit, your great-grandfather, the pious and chivalrous King Pandu, later married Kunti. Vridashrama, the king of Kurusha, married Kunti's sister, Shutadeva, and from her womb, Dantavakra was born. Having been cursed by the sages headed by Sanaka, Dantavakra had formerly been born as a son of Diti named Hiranyaksha. King Dhrishtaketu, the king of Kekaya, married Shutakirti, another sister of Kunti's. Shutakirti had 5 sons headed by Santadharna. Through the womb of Rajadi Devi, another sister of Kunti's, Jayasena begot 2 sons named Vinda and Anuvinda. Similarly, the king of Chedi state married Shutashava. This king's name was Damagosha. The son of Shutashava was Shishupal, whose birth has already been described in the 7th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Vasudeva's brother, named Devabhaga, had 2 sons born of his wife Kamsa. These 2 sons were Chitraketu and Brihadbala. Vasudeva's brother, named Devashava, married Kamsavati, by whom he begot 2 sons, named Suvira and Ishuman. Kanka, by his wife Kanka, begot 3 sons named Baka, Satrajit, and Purujit. King Srinjai, by his wife Rashtrapalika, begot sons headed by Vrisha and Duramashana. King Shamaka, by his wife Shuribhumi, begot 2 sons named Harikesh and Haranyaksha. Thereafter, King Vatsaka, by the womb of his wife, Mishrakeshi, who was an Apsara, begot sons headed by Vrika. Vrika, by his wife, Durvakshi, begot Taksha, Pushkar, Shala, and so on. From Samika, by the womb of his wife, Sudamani, came Sumitra, Arjuna Bala, and other sons. King Anaka, by his wife, Karnika, begot two sons, named Ritadama and Jai. Devaki, Puravi, Rohini, Bhadra, Madhira, Rochana, Ila, and others were all wives on Anakandudubi, Vasudev. Among them all, Devaki was the chief. Vasudev, by the womb of his wife Rohini, begot sons such as Bala, Gada, Sarana, Dharamada, Vipula, Dhruva, Krita, and others. From the womb of Pordavi came 12 sons, including Bhuta, Subhadra, Bhadrabahu, Dharamada, and Bhadra. Nanda, Upananda, Kritaka, Shura, and others were born from the womb of Madhira. Bhadra, or Kaishalya, gave birth to only one son named Keshi. Vasudev, by another of his wives, whose name was Rochana, begot Hasta, Hemangada, and other sons. And by his wife named Ila, he begot sons headed by Uruvoka, all of whom were chief personalities in the dynasty of Yadu. From the womb of Dhritadeva, one of the wives of Anakandudubi, Vasudev, came a son named Viprishta. The sons of Shantideva, another wife of Vasudev, were Prashama, Prasita, and others. Vasudev also had a wife named Upadeva, from whom came 10 sons, headed by Rajanya, Kalapa, and Varsha. From Sri Deva, another wife, came 6 sons, such as Vasu, Hamsa, and Suvamsa. By the semen of Vasudev, in the womb of Devarakshita, 9 sons were born, headed by Gada. Vasudev, who was religion personified, also had a wife named Sahadeva, by whose womb he begot 8 sons, headed by Shruta and Pravara. So this brings us to the verses today, verses 53 and 55. So I'll read the Sanskrit for 53 and 54, then 55 is on the board, we could do together. Pravara Shruta Mukhyamscha Shaksha Dharma Vasumiva Vasudevas tu devakyam ashtaputram ajijanat kirtimantam sushenam cha badrasenam udadadihi rijam sammardanam badram sankarshanam mahisvaram. So now we could do this together. Ashtamas tu tayo asit swayameva hari kila Subhadracha Mahabhaga Tavarajan Pitamahi Ashtama, the 8th one. Two, but Tayo of both Devaki and Vasudev. Asit. Appeared Svayameva directly, personally. Hari, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Kila, what to speak of? Subhadra, a sister. Cha, and Mahabhaga, highly fortunate. Tava, your Rajan, O Maharaj Parikshit, Pitamahi, grandmother. Translation: The eight sons born of Sahadeva, such as Pravara and Shruta, were exact incarnations of the 8 Vasus in the heavenly planets. Vasudev also begot 8 highly qualified sons through the womb of Devaki. These included Kirtiman, Sushena, Bhadrasena, Riju, Samardana, Bhadra, and Sankarshan, the controller and serpent incarnation. And the 8th son was the Supreme Personality Godhead himself, Krishna. the highly fortunate Subhadra, the one daughter, was your grandmother. So Shukadev Goswami speaking to Maharaj Parikshit. Subhadra is Maharaj Parikshit's grandmother. Purport. The 55th verse says, Swayam Eva Hari Kila, indicating that Krishna, the eighth son of Devaki, is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna is not an incarnation. Although there is no difference between the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, and his incarnation, Krishna is the original Supreme Person, the complete Godhead. Incarnations exhibit only a certain percentage of the potencies of Godhead. The complete Godhead is Krishna himself, who appeared as the eighth son of Devaki. Om Ganatim Indasya Gananjana Shalakoya Chakshu Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Namo Vishnu Vidaya Krishna Shtaya Vidale Shri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Tanamane Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shinivadi Pashtatri Shatarine Vancha Kapati Rubishtra Kripa Sinabhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanibhyo Vaishnavimbhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasati Kaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, I'll just read the translation one more time. The eight sons born of Sahadeva, such as Pravara and Shruta, were exact incarnations of the eight Vasus in the heavenly planets. Vasudeva also begot eight highly qualified sons through the womb of Devaki. These included Kirtiman, Sushena, Bhadrasena, Riju, Samardana, Bhadra, and Sankarshan, the controller and serpent incarnation. The eighth son was the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, Krishna. The highly fortunate Subhadra was the one daughter, was your grandmother. Okay. So, in yesterday's verse, we read that Kunti's first son that she had from the sun god was actually Karna. And now we're reading the dynasty, Yadu dynasty, and we hear about Krishna's family, so many of his cousins and his uncles, and now we're hearing of his mother and his father, Vasudev and Devaki. I was born of the eighth son of Devaki. And it's very interesting to understand where these eight sons came from. You know, why were they killed when they were born, right? When they were born from their own uncle. So there's actually a whole history behind why this happened. And first of all, I would like to explain how it describes in the Bhagavatam the different planetary systems. You know, we have Patala Loka, the lower planets, then we have Marti Loka, the middle, and then Swarga Loka, the heavenly planets. And Patala Loka, there are they're primarily subterranean planets where demons actually reside, but they're actually very powerful demons. It's Patala Loka should not be mistaken for Naraka Loka. Naraka is the hellish planets where the sinful entities, they go to suffer from their sinful reaction. So that's Naraka Loka, you know, hellish planets. But Patala Loka is actually very opulent, and it's described that a lot of them are more opulent than the heavenly planets. The jewels, there's like shiny jewels, the women there are very beautiful, and they're there for the demons' enjoyment. And although there is a demonic mentality, it's very kind of like prestigious, very cordial, and there's palaces and things like that. So in the incarnation of Vamanadev, when Krishna came as Vamanadev, Bali Maharaj, who is born in a demonic family, is actually a great personality, great devotee. So we know the story that Vamanadeva, you know, begged for 3 steps of land after Bali Maharaj saw him as, you know, a brahmana, as a brahmachari, and as a ruler, as a king, respecting etiquette. He offered Vamanadeva whatever he wanted. He said, you know, I'll give you your own planet, your own kingdom, whatever you want. Vamanadeva only asked for 3 steps of land. And then we know that, you know, he actually took the whole universe, which actually at that time belonged to Bali Maharaj, because he conquered Indra. So what happened was, after Bali surrendered to Vamanadeva, and he gave everything to Vamanadeva, the Lord was actually pleased by his surrender and devotion. So he said, he blessed him to have more opulence than the king of Indra, or the king of heaven, Indra. And he gave him his own planet in Patala Loka, named Sutala Loka. And Bali Maharaj rules this planet. And not only that, but the Lord said, I'm so pleased by your devotion that I will remain as a gatekeeper of your personal palace. And I'll just remain there perpetually as long as you're there. So, and later on in the 10th canto, Krishna is, what happens was, when Devaki gave birth to these 6 sons and they were killed, Devaki obviously was heartbroken, you know, feeling the affection, motherly affection for these sons. And so after Krishna had left Vrindavan, he came to Mathura, then he manifested Dwarka. Many years later, after Krishna was married, you know, he had sons, he was older by then, Devaki started praying to Krishna and Balaram, and she reminded them of these 6 sons. And she said, can you please bring these 6 sons back to life? You know, bring them to me. I never had an opportunity to have a loving relationship with them. So Krishna knew where these 6 sons had gone. And they actually were on Sutala Loka, Bali Maharaj's planet. So Krishna went there, and he had a conversation with Bali Maharaj, and he was explaining that these 6 personalities on your planet, I'm going to narrate the history. This is what Krishna is telling to Bali Maharaj, that in the beginning of the universe, during the reign of Swayambhuva Manu, these 6 sons were actually sons of Marichi, one of the Prajapatis. And what happened was, when Lord Brahma, got covered over by Yoga Maya, and he became sexually attracted to his own daughter, he started running after his daughter for enjoyment. And these 6 sons of Marichi saw this, and they thought it was kind of a humorous sight. So they started laughing, and they kind of mocked Lord Brahma. And because of this offense to a great soul, their reaction to that offense was that they would have to take birth in the family of a demon, of demons. And so they took birth in the family of Hiranyakashipu. Hiranyakashipu, his son, I forgot his name. Hold on here. Yeah, Kalanemi, yeah. One of his sons was Kalanemi, Hiranyakashipu's son. So these 6 sons of Marichi that fell down into a demonic family, they became the sons of Kalanemi, who was the son of Hiranyakashipu. So they were raised in this family, in Hiranyakashipu's kingdom, and they were trained up how to be first-class demons. And one day they had this idea that they would perform tapasya and perform a yajna for the demigods to attain certain powers, certain benedictions. So when Hiranyakashipu found out that they did this, that they performed tapasya without the permission of Hiranyakashipu, and that they were worshipping someone else other than Hiranyakashipu, Hiranyakashipu became furious at them. He started yelling at them, calling them rebellious grandsons and things like this, and he cursed them, that I curse you that in some lives from now, your next life, your father, your own father will kill you. So this is my curse because of this offense that you did to me. So later on, these six sons actually came as the nephews of Kamsa. And Kamsa was actually, Kalanemi came as Kamsa in Krishna Lila. So Hiranyakashipu's son in his next life came as Kamsa, and these six sons of his came as the six sons of Devaki. So according to Hiranyakashipu's curse, when they were born, they were killed by their own father in a previous life, Kalanemi. And it explains, so this is all going on in Sutta Laloka. Krishna's explaining what I just said all to Bali Maharaj. And he said that once they are, you know, once they were killed by Kamsa, then they went to your abode, and very soon they'll be completely freed from their curse, and they'll go back to the abode of the demigods, and eventually, after some years, they'll attain my supreme abode. So, eventually, Bali Maharaj, he said, okay, Krishna brought these six personalities back to Dwarka, and they were introduced to Devaki, their mother, after so many years of separation. And Devaki, out of motherly affection, you know, out of love, milk started flowing from her breast, and she embraced them. And they actually drank this milk. And from drinking this milk, they became so purified because the milk was saturated with love from a pure devotee, Devaki. They became so purified, all the results of their sins and their offense to Lord Brahma completely eradicated, and they became qualified to enter into the abodes of the demigods. So my spiritual master, it quotes in this particular passage, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Sridhar Swami, who are great commentators on Bhagavatam, and my spiritual master was explaining how Marichi, in the beginning of Swami Bhuvamanu's reign, who was the original father of these six personalities, Marichi actually represents the mind, and his six sons represent the demonic tendencies of the mind, you know, lust, anger, greed, illusion, pride, and envy. And he goes on, my spiritual master goes on to quote Rupa Goswami, Anya Balashi Tishunyam Gyana Karma Dhanavritam Anukulina Krishna Nushilanam Bhakti Uttamam, that pure devotion is freed from any material desire for personal sense gratification, either gross sense gratification, mental sense gratification, in the form of speculation. And he said in a similar way, pure bhakti means to be free from these six enemies of the mind that I just mentioned, lust, anger, etc. So this whole story of these six sons of Devaki being killed by Kamsa is actually symbolic. You know, some people who don't understand Krishna's pastimes properly, I've heard people call the stories of Bhagavatam allegories, things like that. They're not actual stories, but it's something to learn from. But we don't accept that. We accept them as actual stories. But these stories can also be symbolic. They can represent something to learn from in our lives. And this particular passage represents, obviously, and he also says how Devaki's womb represents something too. Her womb represents bhakti, her devotion. So my spiritual master is going on to explain that before Krishna is willing to manifest before a devotee's life, one has to first of all become free from these six demonic tendencies. And then he goes on to explain that after these six sons were killed, who was born next was, you know, the seventh son was Balaram. And Balaram represents, you know, he's Adi Guru, he's the original spiritual master. So this is kind of a sidebar thing, but I was thinking how every year after Janmashtami, we celebrate the day after is Srila Prabhupada's appearance day. And I was thinking how There's a quote that you can't get Guru without the mercy of Krishna, and you can't get Krishna without the mercy of Guru. So that in itself is symbolic, that Krishna, first of all, is appearing in our life some way or another, and he's directing us to the spiritual master who is training us up how to actually come in contact with Krishna in an intimate way. Because as Balaram appeared after the six sons were killed, my Guru Maharaj was explaining that, yeah, the Guru is teaching us how to kill these six enemies, but even after those six enemies are killed, he is still there to train our mind how to have the right consciousness so that one day we can actually attain that goal of meeting Krishna face to face, having a loving relationship with our Supreme Lord. And in a letter to Sankarshan Das Adhikari, who is one of our initiating spiritual masters within ISKCON, he resides in USA, in Austin, Texas, really amazing devotee. Prabhupada wrote to him answering a question, because Sankarshan Das Adhikari was a musician before he joined the movement. He still does music, and he does kirtan with guitar and stuff like that. So he was asking Prabhupada about a musical question, is it okay to play guitar and the kirtan and things like that. And Prabhupada more or less said, it's best if you just chant Hare Krishna, but you could still play the, whatever instruments you're attracted to, things like that. But at the end of the letter, he said, but the main thing is that now you have the opportunity. I want you to qualify yourself to be able to meet Krishna face to face very soon in the future. And Sankarshan Das Adhikari, he basically quotes that letter in almost every one of his classes. He's like made that kind of like his goal in life, that this is the instruction of my spiritual master, is to meet Krishna face to face. So this is Guru representing Balaram, representing Lord Nityananda. This is what the Supreme Lord and the spiritual master want us as an individual, as a disciple, to actually achieve, is to actually see Krishna face to face, interact with him. And it's not that the Vaishnavas are so much after mystical experiences. It's not that we're striving to have some sort of esoteric experience, although these do come naturally in the course of devotional service. But Krishna is more pleased and he's more willing to reveal himself to that devotee who has proved that his life is dedicated to full surrender to humility. So the devotee is actually more interested in a life of dedication rather than some esoteric experiences. And my spiritual master, also on this point, he asked the question in a class that, Krishna, being the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he deserves the most opulent situation. He deserves the most opulent greeting and hospitality. But why would he appear in all places in a dark prison, locked up, in the palace of a demon? And he was explaining that it's oftentimes the most dark situations, the most troubling situations in our lives, that when our sincerity and our determination is tested the most, that Krishna often, when he sees that we pass these tests, will be more happy to reveal himself in those dark situations in our life. So again, he said it's like symbolic that he appeared in a prison. And we know from Chaitanya Charitamrita, the pastime of Madhavendra Puri, when Gopal appeared to him in a dream and said, I'm in this bush and I've been here for a long time and nobody's been worshiping me and I'm really hot and in the winter I'm really cold. Can you please come and get me out of this bush? So Madhavendra Puri, he found Gopal, brought him out. Then in another dream, Gopal said, I'm still feeling like really hot because I've had so much excessive exposure to the sun. My body needs like something cooling. Can you please? And this happened in Govardhan. Madhavendra Puri found Gopal near Govardhan Hill. So the Gopal deity in a dream asked Madhavendra Puri to walk to Jagannath Puri to actually get sandalwood paste and bring it all the way back to Govardhan, which is actually 1,500 kilometers or 1,000-mile walk from Govardhan to Jagannath Puri, and then to get a large amount of sandalwood and somehow walk all the way back to Govardhan. And Madhavendra Puri was like ecstatic from this instruction. He didn't take it as a burden. He was willing to do this because of his love for Gopal. So he actually made it all the way to Jagannath Puri. He got the sandalwood, and he was heading on his way back. But as we know, the Lord intervened in another dream, so he didn't have to walk all the way back to Govardhan. But the point was, Madhavendra Puri was actually willing to do all this for the Lord's satisfaction. And in one purport, Srila Prabhupada, in this section of Chaitanya Charitamrita that I just mentioned, in a purport, Prabhupada mentions how the Lord will often test the devotee's determination of how much willing he's willing to take on a painstaking situation only for the pleasure of the Lord. And he was saying how Madhavendra Puri passed this test. And he says that these tests are actually are essential for the devotee's progress. And in a similar way, I was thinking, you know, there's this phrase that, you know, don't be a fair-weather friend. And what that means is, you know, when it's sunny outside and things are going nice, it's easy to be someone's friend, you know, because everything's happy and jolly. But when times get rough and the weather's not so good and the person's in a tough situation, you're in a tough situation, are you really going to have that person's back? Are you really going to express the true attributes of friendship and be there for that person when he needs it the most? So in a similar way, Krishna will test every single one of us who are willing to surrender in that capacity and determine whether we're a fair-weather friend. Are we performing devotional service because it's pleasurable for us? Or are we doing it because we want to give pleasure to the Vaishnavas and the spiritual master, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? And we often hear that death is considered the final examination. And I was just thinking about this this final exam, how in school, in a university, in high school or whatever, grade school, oftentimes, even if you go out throughout the whole semester, throughout the whole year, and even if you're somewhat serious in your studies, a lot of the times, if you don't pass that final exam, you can't move forward. You don't graduate. And oftentimes, at least in America, the school system is, if you don't pass that final exam, if you don't prove that you've actually learned what you needed to learn in that class, you are actually held back to repeat that class, to repeat that subject. So I was thinking how this could be likened to the human form of life, final exam being death. And if we don't pass that final exam, then we have to repeat the subject again. This could be compared to reincarnation. We have to come back and take it again. And we understand that Krishna's most deepest desire for the living entities in this material world is for us not even to be here, to us to go back to Him. So everything in this universe is constructed and operates in such a way that directly or indirectly, through one lifetime or millions of lifetimes, Krishna is purifying, trying to teach that jiva lessons so that he can go back home, back to Godhead. And my good friend Jay Chaitanya Prabhu, he often says that this universe is actually a university. The universe turns into a university. The whole cosmic manifestation is actually a rehabilitation school for us to learn lessons from. And I was thinking also, this point of final examination being death is that an expert teacher, what he does is he often prepares periodic tests before the final examination, you know, once a week or once a month, to actually prepare that student, his mind, and so that student can determine where he is in his studies, if he's taking it serious enough, if he's memorized what he needs to memorize. So in this, also, you know, in when you're someone's coaching a sport, oftentimes the teacher at a school or the coach will make the practice and the test even more difficult than the actual game time or the actual examination time, so that when that championship game comes or when that final exam comes, the student or the player can glide through it without difficulty because he prepared himself properly. So I was applying this, how Krishna often will test the devotee in very troublesome manners, so to actually help him prepare himself, spiritual master will prepare his disciple. In another purport, Prabhupada gives a sentence, and he says that an easygoing life and spiritual realization, they go ill together. You know, they go ill together. They don't go together at all. And I've had this, I've had personal experience of this in my life. My service in USA and traveling Sankirtan. It's basically as intense as you make it. And some people like it more kind of balanced. You do a few hours of book distribution, a few hours of cooking, a few hours of kirtan, things like that. Or, you know, a couple hours of cooking or whatever. But there are some individuals who just get a taste of full-out Sankirtan. And like I said, it's as intense as you make it. The progress that you make is the endeavor that you put into it. So oftentimes when you just throw yourself in the fire of the Sankirtan mission or in your seva without any time to think about anything else, Krishna appreciates this. And he shows his appreciation by actually, a lot of the times, taking everything away from that devotee's life. Right? He says that you know, people that are dear to me, I give them what they want, but people that are most dear to me, I take everything away so they actually have nothing else in their life except for me. So I kind of have a little bit of testimony of this. You know, I've been severely challenged mentally, emotionally, in my service, and it almost seems, probably many of you can also share many stories of how Krishna has intervened and manifested in your life in this same way. And I feel like it's almost kind of like a little rasa that we have with Krishna, is that oftentimes he takes away, it almost like he feels like he's taking away mercy. Actually, it's the most mercy, but it feels like he's taking away mercy, or he feels like he's taking away, you know, the ecstasy of devotional service or our taste. And oftentimes, at least for me, there's no taste, and my enthusiasm is very nil. And I actually don't know what's going on, why is this happening? And it's almost like a constant pattern that happens. But I've realized through tolerating these situations and making sure that these situations weren't caused by my own imperfections and my own faults, such as Vaishnava aparad, etc. If I make sure that I'm doing everything properly and these things are still happening, then I know that Krishna's up to something. You know, he's got something behind his back that I don't understand. So oftentimes when I go through these tough situations and mentally, emotionally challenged in such a way, I know right behind the corner there's some deep realization and there's a life-changing experience, and my whole perspective on life or perspective on a certain situation completely changes. You know, a devotee can become more mature. He becomes a better person, a better devotee from this mercy from Krishna. And I've noticed, like I was just saying a minute ago, that when you do throw yourself in your service full speed ahead, and service obviously doesn't mean just physical service. We actually have to understand it from, you know, like a mature perspective. Our service means to please. You know, my spiritual master says love means to please, and please means to serve. So service actually means to... Love means to serve, and serve means to please. Thank you for your correction. Yes. So, please. So, service meaning to please, we actually have to understand it from a broad perspective, that what pleases the spiritual master, what pleases Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is Prabhupada wants us to read his books to understand. He says we should understand his books like the lawyers know the law books, and to actually realize that, to actually have that understanding, means many, many years of studying his books over and over again. You can't just read a book one time and know it like a lawyer knows the law books. Srila Prabhupada also wants so many things, whatever, serve the Vaishnav, serve the deities, book distribution, Harinam, list goes on. Everybody knows these things if you read Prabhupada's books. So I don't have to elaborate so much, you get the picture. So, what was I just saying a minute ago? Serve means please. Kind of lost my train of thought. Oh yeah. If we throw ourselves in that service and we fully surrender to it, wide, broad perspective of service, then Krishna actually reciprocates. The more you give, the more you get. You know, Bhagavad Gita 4:11, as one approaches me, Krishna reciprocates accordingly. And in 1972, Srila Prabhupada wrote a letter to Kurandar, who was the temple president of Los Angeles. And I'll kind of paraphrase. It's right here. Basically, I'll just read it. He says that our leaders in our movement shall be very careful not to kill the spirit of enthusiastic service. So this is actually the duty of the leader, to not kill the spirit of enthusiastic service, which Prabhupada says enthusiastic service is individual, it's spontaneous, and it's voluntary. And he says that the leader should always try to generate some atmosphere of fresh challenges to the devotees so that they will agree to enthusiastically rise to a proper standard and meet those challenges. And he goes on to say that this is the art of management, to draw out spontaneous loving spirit of sacrificing one's life energy for Krishna. So we could see this is like a pattern in our philosophy, that the spiritual master, the leaders, Krishna, the Vaishnavas, will indirectly or indirectly present challenges before us. And many times these challenges are very subtle. We don't even understand that they're happening. When we're in the midst of a circumstance, a Vaishnava, another devotee might look at us in a wrong way, or skip us when they're serving out prasadam, or say something that agitates our mind, and it's very easy to react emotionally to the situation. And if one acts emotionally to the situation, often it will create a havoc in their life that is very long-lasting. Like, I have a friend from I grew up with. He was very good at sports, very good kid. But somehow or another, he got involved with gangsters. He joined a gang. Everyone knows what a gangster is, like a mob, like mafia type of people. But in America, when you refer to gangster, it's usually like a low class mafia. Like, they're not very rich, but they, you know, they do crazy things, and oftentimes it leads to violence and against another group or another gang. So anyways, my friend got involved with this, and ever since I known him, he was always trying to impress other people. So when he got into this gang, something happened. I hadn't talked to him for like a year because he got kind of strange. I didn't want to associate with that scene. But something happened when he was at a party where he got mad, and he actually, out of anger, he shot another person, another gang member, and killed him. And I've known this kid since we were little. He was actually a good person. He just got in bad association and reacted emotionally to a situation, and now he's in prison for life, you know, with no chance of getting out. So this is obviously an extreme example, but Vaishnava aparadha is also extremely severe. So we have to learn from Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains how to tolerate these situations, like the winter and summer seasons, they come and go, that one should be humble and not react emotionally to the situation. And this is one of the challenges that Krishna puts before us. How much are we willing to cooperate? Are we actually willing? Are we actually ready and qualified to associate with pure associates of Goloka Vrindavan? Because if we can't participate in associating cooperatively with the devotees in this world, which is a training ground for the spiritual world, then maybe we're not ready for the association of Krishna's pure devotees in Goloka Vrindavan. So I kind of just went off on a tangent there. But the point I was trying to make was, going back to my previous point, why my spiritual master gave the example why Krishna appeared in a prison cell. And it's often because of, in challenging situations, Krishna reveals himself the most. I was asked to leave room for questions, but I do have a few more things to say. Should I say them, or should I have question time? Daivi Shakti Manaji says I should keep speaking. Okay, so in the purport, Prabhupada is explaining how, you know, Krishna is the supreme Godhead, and he is the source of all incarnations. And we know that verse from the first canto, Ite Chamsa Kalapunsa, Krishna is tu Bhagavan Swayam, that all incarnations actually come from Krishna. And this verse is actually considered the Paribhasha Sutra of the whole Srimad Bhagavatam. Paribhasha Sutra is one or a few verses within a book that basically represents this kind of like the pivot point of everything else within the book. You can refer back to that particular verse or those few verses, and it will give you a deeper insight within everything else you read. So, with this verse being the Paribhasha Sutra, that Krishna is the source of all incarnations, we're now on the 9th canto. You know, the next canto, 10th canto, considered the summum bonum. Summum bonum means like the goal or the highest destination of your journey. So the 9th cantos, we've read 1 through 9, so many stories to learn from different devotees, different demons, different allegories we've learned from, different incarnations. But if we keep that Paribhasha Sutra intact while we're reading the 9th cantos, all of it is put into perspective, that all of these incarnations, all the knowledge we're supposed to learn in the 9th canto, is supposed to direct us to our loving relationship with the original Supreme Personality of Godhead, Swayamrup, Shamasundar, Radha Shamasundar. So Prabhupada explains the reason for this in this purport is Krishna is complete, 100%, in all qualities, opulence and sweetness, and any other incarnations, they're not 100% like Krishna, the Swayamrupa Krishna. And in a similar way, Goloka, we know, is higher, Vaikuntha, higher than Ayodhya. And even in Goloka, there are different sections. You know, we have Dwarka, Mathura, and Vraj, and all are actually perfect. But there's perfect, more perfect, and most perfect. And Vraj, Radha and Krishna, is the most perfect in sweetness. It's the highest form of intimacy. And us being Gaudiya Vaishnavas, aspiring to be followers of the six Goswamis, following the teachings of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, generally, people within our line will aspire for this most intimate, supreme destination of Vraj Goloka, serving Radha and Krishna in one of the five capacities, four primary rasas. So I was thinking how, just by reading Krishna book recently, just hearing how actually the Vrajvasis actually also had this conception. They understood this Paribhasha Sutra of Srimad Bhagavatam, because many times they actually kind of chastise, like the gopis would chastise Krishna, or one of the Vrajvasis will refer to Krishna's incarnations in previous yugas. Like I was just listening how the gopis were chastising Krishna how unkind and hard-hearted he is, that in your incarnation of Ramachandra, you know, Sharnapanika actually came to you wanting to unite with you, but instead you just cut off her nose and her ears, and that you know, Bali Maharaj surrendered to you when you were in the form of Vamanadeva, but you're so ungrateful that you just stole everything away from him. And in other places, the Vrajvasis are recognizing that Krishna was actually a Vrahadeva who lifted the earth on his tusks. And when we sing every morning the song by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Vi Bhavari Shesha Aloka Pravesha, we get the same conception, because in a few times he refers, you know, first of all to Nrisimha, to Vamana, and to Lord Ramachandra, you know, the slayer of Ravana. But that whole song is a glorification of Krishna. His glorifying those other incarnations is a glorification of Krishna, that Krishna, you're so awesome and so cool that you actually came in other incarnations, just like Nrisimha and Vamana, and you slayed Ravana, and that was like really cool of you to do that. So I was kind of thinking also on the same point that oftentimes we hear that we're followers of the Mahajans, right? Followers of the Mahajans. But many of those Mahajans, you know, they had kind of Aishvarya Bhav. Actually, basically most of them had this Aishvarya Bhav and awe and reverence. It's kind of like a Vaikuntha mood. So being a follower of the Mahajans doesn't necessarily that we have to adopt that mood, but that they're actually, first of all, they are authorities in the scriptures. They are giving Siddhanta purely for us to realize and for us to give to others. But also their examples of their surrender can actually, we can connect back to this Paripasya Sutra of Srimad Bhagavatam, that these examples of Dhruva Maharaj, his intense determination in his meditation, Prahlad Maharaj and his sincerity and his complete dependence on Krishna and Nrisimha Dev, etc., are giving us, you know, Lord Chaitanya wanted to hear these pastimes of Dhruva and Prahlad over and over again. So it's actually, they give us an example of how we can be determined, how we could be fully surrendered and sold out to our Swayam Rup Shishi Radhasham Sundar Krishna. So everything's connecting back to what Prabhupada is explaining in this purport. Krishna is the Supreme Godhead. And so we can remember this as we're reading through the ninth cantos, and now we're coming up to a very exciting portion of the Bhagavatam where we can immerse ourselves in the pastimes of Krishna in the tenth canto and be absorbed in his life and activities. And just recently I was listening to a class by Srila Prabhupada. He's given a class on Bhagavad Gita in chapter 4, text 9. And he gives this example that when someone is flying from New York City to Los Angeles, what does he have to do before he goes? He has to prepare himself. He has to make sure he has the proper ticket. He has to make sure his baggage is you know, all ready to go. He has to make sure he has, you know, a ride to the airport and that he gets there on time. So he said in a similar way, our preparation for meeting Krishna face to face is this verse that he was giving a class on, Janma Karma Chime Devam Evam Yo Veti Tatvataha, that to be absorbed in Krishna's activities and pastimes is actually preparing us, just like a flight from New York City to Los Angeles, to fly from the material world to Goloka Vrindavan Dham. And it is explained that when you're hearing the pastimes, is non-different from actually being in the pastime. And it's just a matter of realization, just like the mango. Oftentimes that example is given. You have the unripe or the ripe mango. So in the neophyte stage, we're just hearing the pastime. We don't really know what's going on. A lot of times we're doing it just for purification or just because our spiritual master says we should read Krishna book. But the more and more you become mature and purified from this natural process of sadhana bhakti, then that mango becomes ripe and you realize that hearing is non-different from actually experiencing. So one more thing and then we'll leave. In a similar way, I was just listening yesterday, Uddhava is telling the gopis when he came from Mathura to Vrindavan to read this message from Krishna. He was explaining how Krishna's message was telling the gopis, like, you have no need to worry, because actually, philosophically, you're never separated from me, because everything is my energy. Even you're my energy. And your thoughts, everything is my energy, so you're actually never separated from me. And then he goes on to explain, but if you want to associate with me personally, then I recommend, this is Uddhava speaking after this, he says that, well, if you want to associate with Krishna, I recommend devotional service in two ways. Externally, by hearing about Krishna and his activities, and internally, by remembering those activities. And in this way, you'll never be separated from Krishna. So by hearing that, the gopis' anxiety became diminished, and they were always in ecstasy, but you know, their ecstasy turned from anxiety to happiness, or glad, or whatever you want to call it. So that's all I want to say. Thank you so much for allowing me to purify my heart by speaking on the Bhagavatam, and Hare Krishna, all glories to Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Sorry, no questions, right? Because the bell rang. Unless there's a very urgent question, or a comment, or a chastisement, or anything. Anything? Okay, jai, Hare Krishna.